Some of us are just not equipped for suicide. When we're at the bottom, suicide is too creative an act to initiate. Which leaves little Frances at the bottom of the attic stairs. Based on her upbringing and from what she has heard and seen tonight, one thing is clear. The babies up there must be baptized. But she has to be careful. She has to hurry. She mustn't get caught. She stands at the bottom looking up. The attic room has been a place of absolute peace and quiet for the past many months. Until tonight. Her oldest sister has lain up there, not saying anything. Frances and Mercedes have been allowed in to read to her and to bring her trays of food. They have read Black Beauty, Treasure Island, Bleak House, Jane Eyre, What Katy Did, Little Women, and every story in the Children's Treasury of Saints and Martyrs. The two of them decided to look up the hard words next time around, rather than break up the reading aloud. They also got their mother to search out recipes for the invalid food found in What Katy Did and Little Women. Blancmange seems to be the favorite of languishing girls. They never do find out what it is. White eat. What would that taste like? Frances knew Kathleen must be very ill because of the huge lump in her stomach. Mercedes told her it was a tumor. We must pray for her. Together, Frances and Mercedes have prayed for Kathleen. They have made a little shrine and given up sweets for as long as it takes to get her well. So here's Frances at the bottom of the narrow attic staircase. She is almost six. She is not afraid of the dark. Besides, there is a little light coming from that room. And she's not alone. Her big sister, Kathleen, is up there. And so are the babies. The babies, which sound exactly like kittens. Frances is very fond of kittens. She's in her bare feet. She's got her white nightgown on, and her hair is in two long French braids. She gets to the landing. She's too small to be on eye level with the new depression in the wall, just as well. But what does it matter? She saw how it got there. And now the child is entering the room, and she's going to see everything. She's stepping over the splintered, caved-in door with her bare feet. The difference between Frances and James is that, although she sees a version of the same horrible picture, Frances is young enough still to be under the greater influence of the cave mind. It will never forget, but it steals the picture from her voluntary mind, grand theft art, and stows it, canvas side, to the cave wall. It has decided, if we are to continue functioning, we can't have this picture lying around. So Frances sees her sister, and unlike her father, will forget almost immediately. But, like her father, will not get over it. What Frances sees. The gore. The pictures over the bed. The scissors. And the babies, squirming slightly and mewing between Kathleen's legs, where they have been wedged for safekeeping until the priest can be dug up. So, the secret contents of Kathleen's tumor revealed. This gets filed under normal in Frances's mind. Frances devises a way of carrying both babies. She spreads the front of her white nightie on the bed and places the slippery babies on it. She folds them into the fabric, making a cozy bundle. She cradles her bundle of babies and walks carefully all the way down two flights of stairs, with her underpants showing, through the kitchen, out the back door, across the pitch-dark coal clinkers in the backyard, until she comes to the bank of the creek. There is one scary thing, the scarecrow in the center of the garden on the other side of the creek. If toys come alive at midnight, what happens to scarecrows? Frances avoids looking at it. It's just a thing. but she doesn't want to offend it. She lovingly empties the tiny children onto the grass. It's a nice warm evening. Frances regrets that she didn't think to rifle the Hope chest for the white lace gown and bonnet. The outfit that she, Mercedes, and Kathleen were all baptized in. Too late now. There's no time. I have to get this done before Daddy comes home. Frances loves her little niece and nephew already. There is nothing she would not do to make sure their souls are safe. She knows that otherwise they die with original sin on them and go to that non-place, limbo, and become no one for all eternity. Frances has never been up close at a baptism, but she's heard the priest mumble, barely moving his lips. She's seen him dip the baby's head into the water. The priest is praying, that's for certain, so Frances must pray too. Hurry, Frances! Frances makes the sign of the cross. In nomine Padre, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. She looks at the wee babies in the skimpy moonlight. Ladies first. She picks up the girl baby and shimmies on her bum down the embankment to the creek. She wades to the center. The water is waist deep. On wee Frances, that is. Her nightgown puffs and floats on the surface before taking on water and silting down around her legs. She makes the sign of the cross with her thumb on the baby's forehead. Now's the part where you pray. Frances takes a stab at it. Dear God, please baptize this baby. And then her favorite prayer from bedtime. Angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here, ever this day be at my side, to light, to guard, to rule and guide. Amen. Now's the part where you dip the head in the water. Frances tips the baby carefully toward the water. The little thing is still slick and slips through her hands and sinks. Oh, no! Quick! Hen, rooster, chicken, duck! Frances plunges down, grabs the baby before it hits the bottom, then breaks the surface, clutching it to her body. It's okay. Frances's little heart is beating like a bird in the jaws of a cat. She catches her breath. The baby lets out a tiny holler and the sweetest little sputtering coughs. It's okay. It just swallowed a bit of water. It's okay. It's okay. Frances rocks it gently and sings to it a small song composed then and there. Baby, 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 baby. There. At least it's nice and clean now. Frances crawls up the bank again, lays the girl baby down on the grass, kisses her little hands and head, and picks up the boy. She knows that you have to be extra careful with new babies because their heads aren't closed yet. Like a ditch or something along the top of their skulls. It's called a soft spot, even though it's in the shape of a line. You can see it stretching along beneath the layer of bluish skin that's draped across it. Frances didn't see it on the girl baby's head because the girl baby has a weirdly dense thatch of black hair. But there it is on the boy baby's feathery pate, a shallow trench dividing his head in half. Frances enters once more the waters of the creek and lightly traces the pale blue fault line in the infant's skull. What if someone just came along and poked their fingers in there? What would happen? He would die. Frances squirms at the thought that just anyone could come along and do that. What if her fingers just went ahead and did that? Oh, no. Hurry. You have to get him baptized before it's too late. Before Daddy comes home, or before anyone's fingers can press in his head. Frances drops the second baby. Oh, no. Quick! Hen, rooster, chicken! What in God's name are you doing? Frances's head jerks up, arresting her plunge. It's Daddy. There is the great upside-down V of his legs towering at the top of the creek embankment. He's got the girl baby in one arm.
Get the hell out of there!
He's drunk. Otherwise he would never curse in the presence of a child. He reaches down and gets Frances by one arm, easily swinging her up out of the water, her soaked nightgown hanging down past her toes. She could be the little mermaid invited at long last onto the good ship Homo sapiens, ready to try out her new feet, except for the blood stains. The water is dark. James doesn't see the child on the creek bed.
No!
Frances screams as he sets her down on the grass. She can't find the words. She can't tell him. Telling is not an option. This is like a dream. She's forgotten how to say in waking English, "The other baby is in there. He's going to drown. We have to get him out." James tosses her head, herding her in jerks back toward the house. Frances breaks and runs back. He lurches after her. She reaches the edge of the creek and leaps, over the top, splash and plunge. She scrabbles about on the bottom for the baby. Her lungs are stinging. In this water, she's as blind as the newborn she can't find. She finds him. She breaks the surface for the second time as James arrives back, swaying a little at the creek's edge. She bundles the baby to her chest. It stirs once and is silent. She stares up at her father and the girl baby. She starts to shiver. James either says or thinks, "Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ." He slides down the bank, takes the child, and goes through the motions of resuscitation. But it's no use. The boy baby was in the water a good 20 seconds too long. Frances's teeth start to chatter, and she wonders if her black-and-white candy is still at the bottom of the creek, or if it has been washed out to sea. Blancmange. Frances spends the next day in bed, shivering. Her teeth are chattering. She can't get warm. Outside, it's June. Her lips are blue. Mercedes wraps her in several blancets and feeds her pretend blancmange. Pretend because the dish is unavailable to them outside the realm of fiction, and because all Frances can manage to eat for the next couple of days is pretend food. Where's Mama? What with a freezing child in one bedroom and a burning hot infant in another? She's downstairs cleaning. The house is spotless. Frances stops shivering in time to attend Kathleen's funeral, but she still hasn't eaten any real-life food. By now, she has already lost her conscious grip on the events of 2 nights ago, when the babies were born. She has shivered them away. The cave mind has entered into a creative collaboration with the voluntary mind, and soon the two of them will cocoon memory in a spinning wealth of dreams and yarns and finger paintings. Fact and truth. Fact and truth. Where's my nightgown? The one with the... I spilled something. I have to wash it. Remember that fish I caught in the creek that time? I did. There are so fish in there. It had a thin blue stripe, but I let it go. It was just a baby fish. Too small to eat. I threw it back. It swam away, back to the ocean. But the nightgown is long gone, committed to earth by James, who made of it a shroud for an infant boy. And as for the fish, everyone knows there have never been any fish to be caught in the creek. The only thing anyone's ever going to catch in that creek is polio. On the day after Kathleen's funeral, on the third day following Kathleen's death, Frances is still fasting when she is overcome by a powerful craving. She goes to the kitchen, where Mama is getting ready to clean the oven. She opens a long cupboard and takes the lid off the flour bin. She fills her hands with the white dust and carries it carefully across the kitchen and upstairs to her room. Materia sweeps up the thin white trail behind Francis without a word, without looking up, without following it beyond the border of the kitchen linoleum. Once in her bedroom, the one she shares with Mercedes, Francis releases the flower from her hands into the empty porcelain wash basin on her dresser. She adds water from the pitcher and mixes it with her hands until she has a soft, sticky dough. She takes the dough in both hands, curls up on her bed, and begins to suck on it. At first she sucks rapidly, making little sounds, then more slowly as the craving subsides. Her eyelids get heavy and she falls asleep, her mouth filled with the soft, moist mass. Mercedes enters carrying a tray heaped with invisible delicacies. Francis's lips still suck a little intermittently in her sleep. Mercedes puts down the tray, careful not to upset the flagon of port and send it streaming into the blancmange. She bends over Francis and feels her forehead, then gently pries the glutinous white blob from her mouth. She carries it downstairs, following the trail of white powder back to where it ends at the kitchen linoleum, and stops. Not because the trail stops, but because of what she sees. Mama. Mercedes stands staring, the raw dough cupped in her hands like an offering. She was going to bake it for Francis. It's not good to eat raw dough. You might get worms. Mercedes was going to bake it in the oven, but her mother is using the oven. Mercedes stands there for a long time, with her hands full of wet white dust. See no evil. On the night when Lily and Ambrose were born, Mercedes was awakened by the same racket that woke Francis. But Mercedes stayed in bed, while Francis crept out to the attic stairs. Mercedes held on to the blankets just under her chin and said the rosary, even though she was too scared to turn and reach for the beads where they lay under her pillow. It was after this night that Mercedes actually started to wear a rosary on her person, because sometimes even under the pillow is too far away when it comes to a rosary. So Mercedes said the rosary with the tufted nubs of the chenille bedspread instead. Mercedes stares hard at a row of white tufts, but she has trouble getting the rosary going. Not because it's just a bedspread, but because of the devil. Only the devil would block her mind with a picture of the wooden back scratcher that leans against the mirror on her bureau. You can't see it now, it's too dark. But it's there. A long wooden back scratcher carved with three monkeys doing see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. And at the tip of it are three prongs curved like claws for scratching. It was a joke gift from a friend of Mama's at the Empire. Mercedes has just realized that it is an evil thing, and in the morning she will put it in the garbage. No, the furnace. In the morning. When it's light and the sounds from up in the attic have stopped. Someone just started hammering the wall up there. Maybe they're hanging a picture. Mercedes fights the devil and wins. She manages to make the back scratcher disappear from her mind. She banishes it with the first prayer that's able to break through. Angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here, ever this day be at my side to light, to guard, to rule and guide. Amen. Quick, before the evil picture comes back, quick. Hail Mary, Mother of God, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. And the rosary is safely started. And once it's started, you can just keep going around and around for as long as you want or need, following the stepping stones of the bedspread. Yes, in an emergency, you can say the rosary anywhere, provided you have faith. Finally, the house is quiet. Where's Francis? Mercedes creeps softly into the hallway. She looks up the attic stairs. There's a little light up there, but silence. Mercedes has no desire to go up there. Perhaps the thing in the back of her mind takes better care of her than the thing in the back of Francis's mind. Perhaps. Mercedes turns away from the attic door and walks toward her parents' bedroom. On her way, she steps in something sticky. She gives herself a gentle reprimand for not putting her slippers on, and in fact gropes her way back to her room, finds her slippers and her green tartan housecoat and puts them on, tying the flannel belt snugly around her waist, and smoothing down her hair before venturing back out into the hallway. She reaches the door of her parents' room. It's half open. She stands very still and listens. Nothing. No breathing. Her heart leaps for a moment. No breathing. She is young enough to fear that both her parents may simply have died in their sleep. She moves softly toward their bed and reaches out her hands like a sleepwalker, still listening. Will they be there? Will it be their bodies? Will they wake up and be annoyed with her? It's a sin to doubt so much. If you really have faith in God, you won't go around expecting to find your parents dead in their bed for no reason. Say a little prayer. I'm sorry, dear God. Now, let your hands descend gently toward the bed and... Nothing. Empty sheets. What a relief. They're not lying there dead. They're just not there at all. Oh, no. Where are they? It's the middle of the night. Where are my parents? Where is Mama? Where is Daddy? Stop it. You're going to make God angry. You deserve to find them dead downstairs, murdered by a tramp. Mercedes' almost 7-year-old nerves are still tender, but tonight begins a process that will eventually turn them into steel. Her little nerve fibers are being heated up. Tonight is the smelter. When her nerves have been heated up enough, when they are white hot, they'll be plunged into cold water, tempered and strong forever. Strong enough to support a building or a family. Strong enough to prevent the house at 191 Water Street from caving in on itself in the years to come. It will stand. It will stand. But for now, go downstairs. Mercedes' search carries on in this way, listening, listening, looking, looking. She finds no one downstairs. Apparently, she is all alone in the house. Oh, except for Kathleen. Or maybe Kathleen is gone, too. Maybe they've all gone and left her. You could go check, Mercedes. Check in the attic. No. And besides, Mercedes answers, Kathleen doesn't speak anymore. She couldn't tell me where they've gone. You haven't checked the cellar. There's nothing in the cellar but coal and the furnace. It would take a less rational sort of person to conduct the type of search that would result in real information. The type of search that turns up the reading glasses in the icebox and the car keys in the medicine cabinet. But then, it takes a less rational sort of person to misplace things so spectacularly. Or to speculate, perhaps my mother is locked in the coal cellar. I'll just have a little look-see. And it would take the sort of person who can't resist trouble to actually climb those attic steps after the wailing and rampaging that have been issued from that direction. Mercedes can resist. She can hold out against trouble, against curiosity. Someone has to. She returns to her bedroom. She makes the blankets into a cloak around her and sits on her knees on her bed, staring out the window at the moon over the backyard. Our Lady is in the moon. The cool white light is her love. Everything's going to be all right. And finally, Mercedes sees something which is not an absence. It's Francis, Down there in the creek. She's holding something, cradling it. A bundle. And on the embankment there's something moving. A small animal. A kitten. That must also be a kitten she's holding. Frances dunks the bundle, then dives after it. What's she doing? No. No, Frances loves kittens. She wouldn't be drowning them. She's giving them a bath. That's what she's doing. She puts the one kitten down and picks up the other one. But Mercedes doesn't see what happens next, because Daddy comes into the yard and up to the creek, blocking her view. Uh-oh. Frances is really going to get it now. Well, she shouldn't be up playing in the creek at this hour anyhow. In fact, no one's allowed playing in the creek ever. It's not a beach. Mercedes sees the struggle, the extent of Frances's disobedience in running back to the creek, leaping in. Why is she so bad? Some people are just made that way. When Frances comes to bed, she is ice cold. Mercedes pretends to be fast asleep. And in her pretend sleep, she snuggles over to Frances and folds her into her tartan housecoat. Frances is bare naked. This, too, is unusual. But no matter how Mercedes snuggles Frances, Frances goes on shivering. Mercedes will never again sleep through a night. From now on, she will be listening even in her sleep. Someone has to. In the morning, Mercedes notices the blood in her slipper. She washes it out. The only other thing different about this morning is that if you look out at the garden, you'll notice that the scarecrow is gone, and in its place there's a big rock. The Adoration of the Body. James, knee-deep in water, reached up and placed the dead infant on the ground on the far side of the creek, then climbed out after it. Frances was holding the girl baby close against her stained and soaking nightgown, and she made a move to head back to the house.
Stay right where you are.
Frances watches as Daddy squishes in his wet shoes over to the scarecrow. He takes hold of its legs and yanks at it as if he were uprooting a small tree. Its head wobbles and falls off and rolls down the slope into the creek with a splash. The creek begins to carry it away. Frances watches the head bobbing along the water and thinks, "He's going to find my black and white candy. He's going to eat it. He's going to tell someone in a far-off land what I did." The head is carried off and out of sight toward the sea. But the hat remains, the crunched fedora. James tears the scarecrow free of the earth. Its body was impaled on a stake, and that stake must have been greenwood, because now that Daddy has yanked the pointed end from the ground, you can see it is alive with pale sprouting roots. Eventually, a tree would have grown right up through the scarecrow. Maybe with fruit, too. A branch would have grown straight out through his mouth, and on the end of the branch a big red apple. Imagine, thinks Frances. Imagine if you had a tree growing inside you. Imagine seeing the green leaves everywhere, then trapped just under your skin and growing. Imagine seeing the thin roots swirling under the surface of the soles of your feet, their white ends looking for a place to poke through. The earth is a magnet for roots. James tosses the scarecrow across the creek. It lands with a thud next to Frances, its neck bleeding straw, its legs splayed crazy on either side of the teeming wooden stake. Frances can feel the scarecrow looking up at her. It has no head, but she can see its expression anyway, pathetic and sad. Why did you do this to me? Lying there like a dying soldier wanting to give her a message from his dying throat. The location of the enemy, a message for a loved one back home, a piece of a joke, a piece of a poem, the address of his childhood home crystal clear, the memory of a boy drinking from a summer stream in a painting. Or did that really happen? Was that me? Frances doesn't answer. She looks away from the scarecrow, even though she knows it may move if she doesn't keep an eye on it. Her arms have congealed around the clammy little baby. She fastens her eyes on the scarecrow's hat. The hat is lying next to Daddy, and Daddy is digging in the garden with his bare hands. James stops. It's ridiculous to dig anywhere but in a sandbox with your bare hands. But in a new Waterford backyard, it's even more ridiculous. Because there's coal not far under the ground, even coal right at the surface in places, and rock. James is crying. He covers his face with his hands, streaking it with mud and soot and blood. He has never cried like this before, not counting early childhood. He's in the war. Not that he is hallucinating himself back to the front, or hearing shells explode in his head, or seeing chopped-up men. It's not that conscious. It's just that if you ask the layer of his self that's in charge of assumptions, where are we now? It would reply, in the war, of course. There is a water-filled trench. There is an unhappy man with bleeding hands. There is the body of a boy. Of course. Daddy? No. No. Like Santa Claus, only sad. Daddy, I'm sorry. James quiets down a bit and rocks on his heels for a while, making only very small sounds, with his hands still covering his face. The baby's cold, Daddy. James gets up, gasping, swaying a bit, every breath touching off a little moan. But they're just the aftershocks of grief. He can function now. The chest heaving will run its course like a case of hiccups. He looks across at Frances. He splashes through the creek and takes the live baby from her. Her elbow joints unsquinge like damp springs, and her arms levitate in giving up the child's weight, while retaining its warm impression. A phantom baby she will feel in her arms for days to come. James gives her a light shove toward the house. Go to bed now. Go on. Don't hurt her. I won't hurt the baby. Go. Frances goes. Wait. Take off your nightgown. She peels it from her body and James takes it from her. She watches Daddy return to the garden, where he swaddles the infant boy in her nightgown and tucks him into the shallow earth. Frances walks across the yard back to the house, savoring the novelty of the night air on her bare chest. Boys are the only ones who ever get to feel this. There's a bright moon, her underpants glow white, and she pretends to herself that she's really a boy stripped down for a swim at Lingen. She skips across the backyard, feeling light and free. And it's not until she steps out of her damp underpants and snuggles down in bed next to toasty warm Mercedes that Frances starts to feel cold and to shiver. Down in the cellar, Materia is curled asleep on a pillow of ashes behind the coal furnace. She dreams of an expanse of quiet earth embroidered by drought, then a calm sea of sand. In her dream, she is aware that kings and queens are buried in the sand. A wide blue river blinks in the distance. In the river, there is something she needs. But the sand makes her sleepy. Sleepy like Arctic snow. It's not the cold that makes you sleep yourself to death in the Arctic. It's the smooth pallor of the landscape, and the desert has that same smooth pallor, though Arabic. It's the whiteness, the sameness of everything that makes you fall asleep out of life, parched or frozen, and so comfortable when you finally let it roll over in your mind, like a rolling pin over dough. The latch on the cellar door thwacks open, and the airborne part of Materia slams back into her body, her eyes opening on impact. She has fallen awake. His shoes squish heavily down the steep wooden stair slats. He stumbles a bit at the bottom, because there's no light down here, and he hasn't brought a lantern. Materia doesn't move a muscle. She is a pair of eyes now. That's all she is, a desert with eyes. James has either forgotten she's there or doesn't consider it of any importance. He yanks open the door of the cold furnace and tosses in a load of bloody sheets, douses it with kerosene, and lights it. The sudden glow across his face startles even Materia, and tears spring to her eyes. There is nothing sadder than the devil. Tears spring to her eyes because in this light, in firelight as in candlelight, the essential beauty of a person is evident. Candlelight is kind and caressing, and therefore a natural companion to romance. The essential James is what the flames illuminate, and it's splintering what's left of her heart. The sight of him as he was so long ago, the two of them alone in the hunting cabin out of season, with his gift of his mother's tartan blanket, and the song, and his bliss at the sound of her mother tongue. He loved her, but she didn't know she was supposed to save him. She didn't know. He must have fallen down and hurt himself just now because his face is dirty. He's been crying, and his cheeks are striped with blood. He sprinkles a little more fuel onto the flames. Materia can't stay by the furnace much longer, what with it heating up like this. If he doesn't leave soon, she will have to move and betray her presence. But he shuts the potbelly door, and the glow dies down. His sweet agony disappears, and is replaced by the shadows of the face she has come to know. And Materia ceases to feel the lump in her throat. As he heaves and shifts the weight of himself from one foot to another up the steps, Materia wipes the tears from her face with her sooty hands. She unwedges her body and drags it along the cinder floor behind her until she can stand up in it again, and goes back to being nothing but a pair of traveling eyes. Before dawn, with Mercedes still sound asleep beside her, Frances opens her eyes and sees a black woman staring down at her. The woman reaches out and lightly strokes Frances's forehead. She does the same to Mercedes and then leaves. Frances falls back asleep. Candy. She dreams of candy. The night is bright with the moon. Look down over Water Street. On the lonely stretch between where the houses end and where the sea bites into the land, a tree casts a network of shadow that stirs and bloats in one spot, as though putting forth dark fruit that droops, then drops from the bough. It's a figure come out from under the branches and onto the street. It stops, drifting in place like a plant on the ocean floor. Then it travels again all the way down the street to the graveyard. It passes among the headstones that have flourished with the town. But it does not linger at the freshest mound. It continues to the edge of the cliff. There, it lies down on its stomach, and places its neck upon the lip of the precipice, as though the earth were a giant guillotine. It looks straight out to the sea that stretches 4,000 miles due east, and sings. Is it possible that the Atlantic conducts the song across its waters until, thirsty and ragged, the song reaches the Strait of Gibraltar, revives a little with the refreshment of its own echo off the Rock of Ages, and continues its journey, turning on its tattered axis all the way to Lebanon, where it finally loses momentum and rests in the air for a moment before descending in soft arcs to the sandy shore below, to sleep there in peace and forever at last. When Mrs. Lvovitz opens her back door at 3 that morning, she gets a fright. There's someone in her garden, just standing there at a slight tilt, as though blown that way by a wind that since died down. Mrs. Lvovitz woke up because she heard something. A woman singing, of all things. She couldn't make out the words. It didn't wake Benny. Hard not to think banshee. Sometimes they wail. Sometimes they weep or just sing softly. But their message is always the same. Someone will cross over. By the time Mrs. Lvovitz got her eyes properly open, the singing had ended. But she looked out the front window anyhow. Nothing. Just to be sure, she went downstairs and opened the back door. And that's when she got the fright. A figure stood in her garden with its back to her. Fear turned to surprise the next instant when Mrs. Lvovitz recognized the shape. Materia! Materia does not turn around. She does not stir. She is a ripe stalk planted in shallow soil, top-heavy, about to fall over, roots up. Just a baby's breath will do it now. Mrs. Lvovitz walks between the beans and tomatoes until she is close enough to touch Materia's arm. It is cool and smooth and plump. Materia's hair is loose. It hangs in wiry black waves that just touch her shoulders. She's wearing one of the loose cotton dresses that Mrs. Lvovitz helped her sew, soft and favorite now with age, covered in faded wildflowers. Materia turns at the touch, and Mrs. Lvovitz sees the front of her.
Gott in Himmel!
Materia stands in Mrs. Lvovitz's tub, while Mrs. Lvovitz washes her. They're in the kitchen with the fire going. The water is black with coal dust and blood. Materia's dress is on the floor. The front of it is a scab. It will be thrown out. Mrs. Lvovitz washes her gently. No scrubbing, no cloth. With her soap-sliding hands only, as though Materia were a newborn. It's a milky skin Materia has, not in color, but in texture, all curves, compact muscle under a soft sheath. Materia doesn't say anything. All the effort and anxiety of distinguishing one thing from another drained away forever, all distances now equal. Mrs. Lvovitz's face in the Cape of Good Hope, Materia's own warm body, and the rest of the world. Mrs. Lvovitz has sent Benny to the Piper House to find out what in God's name is going on over there. When he arrives, he finds James in a clean white shirt making tea at 3:30 a.m. The house is very warm, hot. Kathleen is dead upstairs under fresh linen. There's an infant girl asleep in a crib by the stove.
I'm sorry for your trouble, James.
Thank you, Ben. Will you have a drink? Cup of tea.
In the morning, Mercedes awakens next to Frances and sees a black smudge on her little sister's forehead. It looks like ashes from the fireplace. Mercedes licks her finger and cleans it off. Frances sleeps on. While dressing, Mercedes notices a similar smudge on her own forehead. She wipes it away. Frances wakes up. Mercedes, I dreamed that the lady who gave me the candy came into our room last night.
What lady?
The dark lady. She touched me. Mercedes knows that it was the devil, and that they were protected by a rosary. The devil would leave a coal smudge on your forehead. It would be like him to mock what the priest does on Ash Wednesday. And it couldn't have been Our Lady. Everyone knows Our Lady is pure white in a blue dress. It was just a dream, Francis. She was beautiful. Mercedes says a silent prayer for her sister. She's my fairy godmother, says Francis. Mercedes puts the rosary around Francis's neck and goes downstairs to help Mama make breakfast. Francis curls up on her side and shivers. Daddy is waiting for Mercedes in the kitchen. He has made porridge for her. She sits down at the table.
Good morning, Daddy.
I need you to be a big girl, Mercedes.
He looks at her. They have the same eyes, though hers are brown. Their faces are of sandstone, though hers is tinged with olive. Mercedes understands that the worst is coming and unfolds her serviette, placing it neatly on her lap. She's glad she took special care with her braids this morning.
Your sister Kathleen has been taken away from us.
Has she gone to New York City?
She's gone to God.
A gap opens up in Mercedes' stomach. She bridges it by picking up her spoon.
Thank you for breakfast, Daddy.
I need you to look after your mother.
Is Mama sick?
No, but she's very tired. She just had a baby.
Oh!
Mercedes shows her teeth politely and gets her first permanent wrinkle.
A boy or a girl?
Another little sister for you.
Oh!
The second permanent wrinkle.
Mama is very sad about losing Kathleen. She's too tired to look after the new baby.
I'll look after it.
That's my girl.
Don't worry, Daddy.
The official version. She endured the most severe trials with a calmness, fortitude, and resignation which are the best proofs of the innocence of her life. Epitaph, Halifax Cemetery. Materia had done the Roman Catholic thing. The mother had died. And James, of course, had not been in attendance at the birth, and had therefore been in no position to apprehend the danger or to intervene. So there was no inquest, and the examining doctor and the undertaker kept the details to themselves and their wives. One child was born. Kathleen looked lovely, God rest her soul, so young and lifelike,
just as though she were asleep.
They buried her in white. It should have been her wedding dress. The influenza, you know. There's not a family on three continents hasn't been touched by it. And her, with her God-given gift and her whole life ahead of her. Everyone knew that Kathleen was pregnant and that she died of the child. You'd have to be an idiot not to have figured that out, what with the girl's hasty homecoming and incarceration in the house. But the thing you do in a case like this is go along with the idea that the child is the offspring of its grandparents. Everyone agrees to this fiction, and the only people who'd breathe a word of the actual facts to the illegitimate child are those who are so malicious to begin with that they are easily dismissed as liars. And, in truth, they are. For the beneficent lie tells the truth about the child, which is, you belong to this community. Whereas the malicious truth-tellers use fact to convey a lie, which is, you don't belong. This is an imperfect system, but it's the prevailing one. And as the years go by, the facts get eroded and scattered by time, until there are more people who don't know than people who do. Mahmoud mourns. Mahmoud never wants to see Materia or her husband or her children or any evidence of them ever again. The only communication he's had with the Piper family for the past 19 years has been the business arrangement with James. And they've both done well out of that while never once coming face to face. But that's over now. Kathleen was the one Mahmood invested in, was proud of. But he ought to have known that exposing the girl and her gift to the world was exactly prostitution. She went out and reaped the wages of her parents' vanity, in the case of James, and stupidity, in the case of Materia, and wound up a tramp. It's what happens. Where did she do it, and who did she let do it to her, and how often? Who was it? Some Anglo dog, son of an Anglese bitch with no respect for people's daughters, or worse, a Jew? New York is full with them, or worse, a colored man, likewise thronging in that city. And once that's in the blood, it sleeps there for generations until you least expect it. Where was her father when his daughter was being ruined in the worst city in the world, where people mate like mongrels? And now, a bastard in the family, another girl to boot. My son-in-law is truly cursed. Bad from the beginning, bad in the end. I wash my hands. Mahmood is enraged to find himself choked with tears as he looks at the lily-white girl in the casket with her copper hair spread out around her. He's never seen her up close before, and he fumes that they would dare to send her to her grave in white. In white they would send her to God who sees all. And there's my idiot daughter at the organ. I should have broken her fingers at birth. I should have dismantled the piano and shot the bastard piper. I was merciful, and look at the result. Mahmood scans Mercedes and Francis sitting scrubbed and gleaming in the pew next to James, who looks positively bleached in his black suit. If he's smart, he'll have the older one in a convent, and the younger one out of the house and married before her first period. Damn them all to hell.
The rocking chair. James takes his last drink on the night of Kathleen's funeral. It's after midnight when he comes in from the shed, sits down at the piano in the front room, and plays. The opening bars of Moonlight Sonata, and many other pieces. Upstairs, Mercedes awakens when the music stops. Francis is not in bed. Mercedes sits up and looks out the window, expecting to see Francis down at the creek again. But no. Mercedes leaves the room and pauses on the landing, looking down. There's a light coming from the front room, and something else coming from the kitchen. A smell. It's late at night, but Mama's cooking kidneys for a pie. Daddy's favorite. Mercedes takes one step down, two steps, three, and stops to listen. A little sound like a puppy. Mercedes thinks of the kittens in the creek the other night and shudders. She doesn't like it when Francis goes roaming in the dark. She wishes everyone would just stay in bed at night. She wishes she were back in her own cozy bed, too. But she is the eldest now. Mercedes places her hand lightly on the railing and descends toward the light spilling over the bottom of the stairs. She rounds the archway of the front room and stops. It's all right. Francis is alive, alive-oh. She is in the rocking chair with Daddy. It's funny that Francis seems already to have been looking at Mercedes, even before Mercedes arrived in the doorway. It's Daddy making the puppy sound. He is sad because Kathleen died. He needs his other little girls all the more now. Francis is sitting nice and still, not squirming for a change. Mercedes waits until the rocking chair stops, and Francis slides from Daddy's lap to join her in the doorway. As they walk upstairs hand in hand, Francis says, "It doesn't hurt," Mercedes says. "I don't like that smell of kidneys cooking," and Francis says, "Me neither." Back in bed with Francis cuddled once more at her side, Mercedes starts to feel afraid, and a bit sick to her stomach, although she can't understand why.
She rises, goes over to the wash basin, and throws up. It must have been that smell of kidneys cooking that got her upset, because why was Mama making meat pies in the night? And are there really places where people put children into pies and eat them? It's a sin to think that about Mama, but Mercedes can't help it. She knows there couldn't really be a baby in the pie, but she also knows that whenever she loses track of Francis, bad things happen. The First Holy Sacrament.
Daddy, where's Mama?
I need you to be a big girl, Mercedes.
The first thing James did after dragging Materia's body up to the bedroom was run and get the priest. Not for Materia, too late for her, for the baby girl. James has caught on. There is a God. There is a devil. Necessary evil. You may be cursed, but at least God has a plan for you. The alternative to believing is buckling under the weight of irredeemable guilt and the meaninglessness that used to be your free will, ceasing to function. And that is not an option. He has a family of motherless children depending on him. He sent the priest on ahead, then ran for the doctor. The baby girl is on fire with poliomyelitis, or infantile paralysis. You don't have to be an infant to get it. The house is quarantined. It doesn't make much difference. There never have been many comings or goings, but now it's official. The doctor has taken his pot of black paint and slapped an X on the front door, as he has on so many others. Every day, people spit on their thresholds front and back, declaring, "No disease in my house." But the charm has lost its power. There's disease everywhere. Stealing center stage from the last regular cast of diphtheria, TB, scarlet fever, and typhus is Spanish influenza. You don't have to be Spanish to get it. In 1918 and 19, the flu kills millions more people worldwide than the war did. Many believe the disease spread from the rats that fed off the corpses in the trenches. The graveyard has sprouted afresh with little white crosses carved with cuddlesome lambs. Children have been hit particularly hard. Mercedes has just finished first grade. She goes to Our Lady of Mount Carmel School, and up until the summer holidays she had to wear a white surgical mask to class, like all the other children, so as not to spread germs. "Miss Polly had a dolly who was sick, 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 so she called up the doctor to be quick, quick, quick." All through town, groceries are left at the bottom of yards along with the milk. No one wants to get near. Even doctors and nurses are dropping like flies. Coal deliveries are carefully monitored. If a coal cart delivers a load you never ordered, look out. Someone's going to leave your house in a box. If a black horse stops in front of your house for no reason, start praying. If a white horse comes in the night, forget it. The doctor stands on one side of James, looking into the crib. The priest stands on the other. He is wearing his vestments and holding cruets of holy water and oil. James has no idea that the infant has already been baptized. He doesn't know that's what Francis was doing out there in the creek. He just knows she's bad. As for the night of Kathleen's funeral, well, he won't be touching another drop of anything stronger than tea from now on. The priest will baptize the baby without picking her up, because to move her at this point in her illness would be very dangerous. He asks James, "Who will stand as godfather for the child?" "I will," says James, "since there's no one else but the doctor in the quarantined house, and he's a Protestant." The Holy Roman Church has been waiting for James all along. He thinks back to his own forced baptism years ago when he married Materia. He stood defiantly with his head unbowed while a priest mumbled words over him. "The voice of the Lord is mighty. The voice of the Lord is majestic. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars of Lebanon." He endured it as a sham. But now he knows there are no accidents, only tests. The church is full of examples of men like him, who thought themselves damned and yet were saved. Men equal parts monster and martyr. And through one last act, perhaps occurring invisibly and deep within the heart at the hour of death, they were saved, even sainted.
"And who will stand as godmother?" inquires the priest.
James opens the door to where Mercedes is waiting. He has her stay on the threshold, well back from the seething crib. Mercedes' hair is freshly, though unevenly, braided. She is not yet used to doing it herself. A blue gingham pinafore, stockings of red because blue and red match. The priest doesn't flinch. In the eyes of the church, a child can stand as sponsor in an emergency, and besides, it is fairly clear this baby will soon be with God. Godparents must promise that should anything happen to the child's parents, they will bring the child up in the Roman Catholic faith. This is usually a hypothetical vow, but not for Mercedes, because Mama is already dead.
"I'm the mother now," she tells herself. "And I've had my confirmation, so I'm ready."
Last May, Mercedes put on an immaculate white dress and veil, and along with the rest of her shiny, clean classmates, was ritually slapped by the bishop. Three of her classmates have since died. Dottie Dugan died. She sat next to Mercedes. Dottie had the disgusting habits of eating glue and picking her nose, but now she is one of God's angels. Mercedes chose St. Catherine of Siena as her saint's name, even though she badly wanted Bernadette. But Bernadette isn't a saint yet. When, oh when? Francis told Mercedes to take Veronica as her saint's name because of Veronica's magic hanky.
Not magic, Francis. Miracle.
The priest leans over the crib where the infant lies on its little bed of coals, and he asks it,
"Quo nomine voceris?"
In the doorway, Mercedes and James answer together on behalf of the baby, "Lily." James hasn't thought of a middle name. There hasn't been time. He just prays that she'll grow up to use this one. The priest continues,
"Lily, quid petis ab ecclesia Dei?"
Mercedes and James reply, "Faith." They have a special dispensation to reply in English, because Mercedes is too young to have learned all that Latin, though she would have tried had there been time. Mercedes is longing for a look at her new baby sister. She watches as the priest bends down and blows softly three times into the crib. He is blowing away the unclean spirit to make room for the Holy Spirit, the Consoler.
"Exorciso te, immunde spiritus, maledicte diabole."
The priest spends a long time blessing Lily and praying over her. Mercedes and James say the Apostles' Creed and the Lord's Prayer. And then the priest resumes his questions.
"Lily, abre nuntius Satanae."
"I do renounce him."
"Et omnibus operibus eius."
"I do renounce them."
The priest anoints Lily's head with oil as the godparents attest to her faith in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body and life everlasting. Finally, he sprinkles holy water onto the burning forehead. It beads into the oil and simmers there as he baptizes her,
"In nomine Patris, e Filii, e Spiritus Sancti."